This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review, a survey of important news from all over the world. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff, Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
Anthony Chibadirwe.
Hello.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
We're going to get straight into events from this past week. Last Friday night, of course, were the terrorist attacks in Paris that killed about 130 people. This is the cover story of this week's Trumpet Weekly, our digest of the week's most significant news. You can get a free copy of this report at thetrumpet.com. We have about half a dozen other articles on what happened in Paris and its ramifications in this week's edition. And to give us a rundown of these stories, we're going to turn to Richard.
Okay, well, there's a huge amount that we could talk about the bomb attack in Paris last Friday. But to start, I think the first and most important point to make is just look how much 9/11 changed America. It completely revolutionized every aspect of foreign and domestic policy in America for a decade and more. And we're looking at an event as big as that now playing out in Europe. So it's important, as we look at a bit of this aftermath now, it's important to realize that we're not going to see all of the consequences of this within the first week. You know, after 9/11, the Iraq war came in 2003, about 2 years later. So there could be huge consequences of events like this that we may not see for some time. This is just the beginning. And actually, we even have an article in the Trumpet Weekly called France's Forever War that shows that this attack, in all probability, is not going to be an isolated event. These kind of things are going to keep on coming. But one of the most interesting aspects to me and what I'd like to kind of focus on today is the public opinion in Europe and how that is changing. We have an article from the New York Times and this week's Trumpet Weekly called After Paris Attacks, A Darker Mood Towards Islam Emerges in France. And Mr. Fleury talked about this article earlier in the week on his program, and it notes how in France, after this attack, you don't have as many people now saying, well, this has nothing to do with Islam. In the past, you'd get those marches in solidarity with Muslims. But now there's much more suspicion of Muslims. It notes secular France has always had a complicated relationship with its Muslim community. But now it was tipping towards outright distrust, even hostility. But I think perhaps the biggest and most interesting changes are actually taking place in Germany. They were already in a political crisis about immigration before this happened. Completely separate to that, they were already having a kind of national discussion on the role of their military and how involved it should be in the rest of the world. There's already a discussion going on about how much leadership Germany should take in Europe. And then this attack just really puts a much more intense focus on all of these questions that were already contentious issues. And just to illustrate that, there was a result of a very interesting survey were published over the weekend. And this was a survey done before the Paris attacks. And I think even without those Paris attacks, we may well have been talking about this as our top news today. It was a survey that showed some very dramatic things about Germany. A clear majority of Germans, it found, want a foreign and security policy that is involved in international operations. So 2/3 said that Germany should help in crises around the world. And only 27% said that Germans are of the opinion that they should focus more on their own problems in their own country. That in itself isn't necessarily a big story. But what is huge about this is how much it has changed. Just 2 years ago in 2013, 43% said that Germany should participate in international missions, and 45% said they should focus more at home. So 2 years ago, 45%, nearly half, said Germany should focus more at home. Now only 27% say that. 2/3 want Germany to get more involved in peacekeeping operations, more involved in these war zones.
Did you say that this survey was before the attacks or since the attacks?
That's right. It was published after the attacks, but the actual survey work, the work of asking people, was done before the attacks.
So you can only expect an intensification of these views.
Absolutely. Yeah, and probably a pretty massive intensification. And this was all, just another fascinating bit from this survey, is 50% want more money spent on the army. And 2 years ago, it was just 19%. So the number of people wanting more money spent on the military is more than doubled.
So let's just take a quick rundown of potential reasons why people would have shifted so dramatically over just the last couple of years. You look at what Russia is doing. You look at what all of the unrest in the Middle East that really even preceded this immigration crisis, but what has precipitated that immigration crisis.
Absolutely. And then you've also got the leadership from Germany's leaders, because we've got to remember the German president and then some of the top leaders of all different political parties have been pushing and going out ahead of public opinion in terms of pushing more German military involvement. And I think this is now proof that the public opinion is catching up to where those leaders have been trying to take it.
You know, you were talking about the change in the reaction among the French public after this attack versus some of the prior attacks, and just how much more grim, how much more mistrustful of Muslims there are, the people are. It really does seem, you know, you're talking about some of these factors and just how we already were seeing a shift in German public opinion, that this attack came at a time where it's almost hitting the crest of a wave that was already in motion, and it's just adding a whole other level of emotional impetus to this trend.
Absolutely. And if you want an idea of where that emotional impetus is going to push German public opinion, you can take a look at the newspaper headlines that are coming out in Germany. And we have another article in the Trumpet Weekly from German Foreign Policy that talks about how across the media, people are calling this a new world war. So the Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung, World War, Tagspieler, the West, in fact, the entire planet is in a third world war. Another newspaper, the fight against the Islamic State, the Taliban, Boko Haram, is not being waged with the necessary intensity for a world war. And then another talked about how the struggle against terrorism is failing because of half-heartedness. Another, we need to step it up. So,
And they're talking about a religious war.
Yes, yeah, a war against Islam, and or at least radical Islam. And the other thing about these headlines even is I think that most of these are from earlier in the week. Later in the week, we're now starting to find out that bomb scare in Hanover looked like Germany came really close to having its own Paris attack on its own soil. And that's now just filtering out into the press. There's still a lot unclear. But it looks like that Germany may have just been a couple of hours away from a similar attack in Paris. And if that is confirmed, that's going to have an even bigger impact on public opinion. And that's going to push this even further.
Yeah, it is inevitable. It's inevitable that something like that is going to take place within Germany. And the fact that the German public, it's bracing itself for that type of event in a sense that I think the way that they're expressing solidarity with the French after this attack shows how they really do understand that this is that they're next on the list.
Yes, and again, just to come back to how this is impacting them. Another way we can get an indication is just opinion polls and the Alternative for Deutschland party that have been speaking out against immigration for months and months and months. In August, they had 3% approval rating. Now they're at 10.5%, and they're more than some of the more traditional smaller parties in Germany, more popular than the Left Party, more popular than the Green Party. So there is definitely that empathy and sympathy with Paris and this sense that, well, if it can happen in Paris, it can happen here. So there is definitely a very real fear of what could happen in Germany, as well as that solidarity. I mean, you've got to remember, in modern Europe, you know, for me personally, it's probably every bit as easy for me to travel to Paris as it is to get to York or to Edinburgh or Glasgow, some of these places that are in my own country. And it's the same for a lot of Germany. Paris is a very familiar city. So it is having a big impact.
How much, we were even talking earlier in the week, how crisis is a great unifier. And here we see playing out in the headlines, on the sports fields, Europeans basically recognizing that if we're going to face down this threat, we're going to have to do it together. And it's interesting. I'm just looking at the Trumpet Weekly. Here we have one other article here from Bloomberg Business where Chancellor Angela Merkel is saying, you know, we can handle these refugees, and she's doubling down on her stance with the refugees.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, that kind of that surprised me a lot, because Angela Merkel is one of these, you know, she had a reputation for bending with public opinion. You know, after the Fukushima disaster in Japan, for example, is the classic example of this. She's suddenly pirouetted and completely turned on nuclear power. These big about faces are not foreign to her way of thinking. So I thought she might try and slowly change course, or even make this dramatic turn of, okay, well, we've got to close down the borders. But she's not doing that. She's completely ignoring all of these voices talking about this and telling her that she needs to make these changes. And as you said, she's doubling down. And I saw one German newspaper was talking about how it's the beginning of the end for Merkel. And there's more and more people saying, well, if she's going to go this way, how much longer can she last in German politics? Because the entire mood of the country is not just against her, but shifting further and further in the opposite direction.
Right. Just as Stephen Fleury has been bringing out in his program, it just highlights the inevitability of a change in leadership, that you have people like Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, who is making statements that are the public is far more excited about, like we talked about on the cover story of the November-December Trumpet. That change is, it looks like it could happen any day.
Yes, and it's not just, I mean, definitely the German domestic politics. There's a lot of people there that are sounding much more tough. All of the top people in Merkel's coalition in her Conservative Party are much, much tougher than she is. But look at European politics as well. We've talked about Viktor Orban in Hungary is one of the most obvious examples of this. But even the Polish leaders are much more against immigration and have shifted much more against immigration, even in this last week. The Czech president, another article we've got in the Trumpet Weekly, attending the 26th anniversary of the Velvet Revolution by going to an anti-Muslim rally and telling the crowd of people turning out, rallying against immigration, Islam, telling them, you're not extremists. And so a lot of politicians within Europe, a lot of Merkel's colleagues, are also shifting to this very different point of view.
Well, Richard, is there any other stories that you wanted to cover in this segment before we move on?
Well, I guess I'll just mention the top story on the cover of the Trumpet Weekly, Paris attacks, a milestone in European unity. I won't talk about that too much because we covered that on this program on Wednesday. But you know, really, when something like this happens, all of the attention naturally gravitates onto the military options, on the big siege in Saint-Denis, the bombing in Syria, all of that. And it's easy to overlook something like this. But this shift now where France is looking to Europe to help it with its defense instead of NATO is a major shift. And that's the kind of thing that 2, 3, 4 years down the line, if things go on that far, this could be the biggest thing that comes out of these Paris attacks, their biggest legacy, if I could put it that way. So if you didn't hear us on Wednesday, if you haven't read that article, I'd also recommend going and taking a look at that.
And just briefly, since we spoke earlier in the week about that subject, any further indication of, say, the enthusiasm of the Germans to participate in that kind of initiative in support of the French?
To be honest, I don't think it's necessarily changed much since the beginning of the week, but it's more they were willing and they're enthusiastic back then, and that's just continued. It takes time, a lot of time in Germany, to actually get everything lined up to get involved in military activities. The Bundestag, the parliament, has to have the final say. So I think it's going to take now a few days for all the different political parties to get down, to sit down, to work out exactly what the practical nuts and bolts of their responses are going to be. But in terms of the emotional response and the public support, it's maintained exactly as it was, to get more militarily involved in the world to help France out. Now they're just trying to decide, well, where are we going to get involved?
Right. If these headlines are any indication from all of these German papers that you were reading earlier about this being a world war against the Islamic State, when you have mainstream German papers talking about war on the scale of what they're describing, this is really something to sit up and take note of.
Absolutely. And this is the other thing I'll note in response to what those German papers are saying, is they're also talking about much more containment within, of freedom within Europe and within Germany. So they talked about, for example, an EU anti-terrorist headquarters with police and intelligence service in one complex. So another example of how it's pushing them together. But then they're also talking about deploying the army on the streets. That's a big development within Germany. But then, as one newspaper put it, freedoms which should be protected will be curtailed. They're talking about much more heavy surveillance, much more monitoring of what's going on the internet. And I think there certainly is some room to tighten that surveillance up. But I think we also need to kind of watch for Europe to go to the other extreme in that regard as well.
Thank you, Richard. I'd like to transition right into our Anglo-America segment, which is closely related to this. In some ways, this is the opposite of what we're seeing in Europe. Robert, why don't you go ahead and give us your top story for this week?
Sure. So with the terrorist attacks in France earlier this week, it's starting to stir ramifications in the United States now. And people are starting to ask questions about whether or not this should impact America's policy, how many migrants or refugees we should accept, are they a threat to the nation? And over this last week, we've seen a lot of comments from Republican governors and states and Republican presidential candidates. And the apparent consensus that seems to be appearing is America needs to be much more careful, and we need to slow down how many refugees we accept. And President Obama was not very happy with that this week. He came out and criticized much of that talk, calling it un-American to not accept refugees that are coming here. He, of course, says he wants to accept at least 10,000 more Syrian refugees this year, if possible. And it's really setting up a political and ideological battle. The Wall Street Journal is asking this week, after this, should we actually be posing a religious test on those that come to America? And a lot of people thinking of that would automatically, I think, say, what? I mean, that's really un-American. But the question they say is, well, look, in the past, America has been very open to immigrants and refugees. After World War II, we took in many, many Jews. We took in, after the Vietnam War, many Vietnamese. But those refugees that were coming here did not hate America. They did not want to destroy America. And it left their wars and their ideologies largely with them when they came to America and they started over. And as the Wall Street Journal points out, they said France is learning the hard way that this is not happening with Islam, with Muslims. And when they migrate to your nation, they bring Sharia law with them. They bring the radical forms of their religion. It stays in the mosques and it becomes a breeding ground for these radicals. And the Wall Street Journal is asking the question, do we want that in America? And I think a lot of people who might just react and say, well, that won't happen to America, you know, we'll vet them, those sorts of things. The Wall Street Journal is saying we need to wake up to reality. And I think it is a good question. We have another article in this Trumpet Weekly that brings up that over the past year and a half, the last 18 months, over 70 Muslim ISIS supporters have been arrested in the United States for planning terrorist attacks in America. This is 70 people. And what I found disturbing about this, even more disturbing about this, wasn't the fact that many of these were refugees that came over here, brought the radicalism with them, that snuck through, got through the vetting process and made it over here. I mean, that in itself is worrisome. But among those 70 were also second generation Muslims here in this country that are subscribing to this radicalism.
Yeah, it's really interesting this, how what has happened in Paris really seems to be a tipping point. Like we were talking about with Richard, the fact that you've had a much more, say, a larger percentage of the French and who have had more of an open border kind of a mentality, and the idea that multiculturalism is wonderful and we need to admit, you know, the more diversity the better. But we're really seeing a dividing line here with the ones who are saying, no, wait a minute, we really have to challenge that view based on the facts. What's happening here? And it seems like within the United States, even what you see developing in the presidential election, you have a very clear divide between those who are, say, supporting a candidate like Donald Trump, who's essentially his entire candidacy could largely be ascribed to the fact that he is trying to close the border. And it just keeps hammering this immigration point. And those who continue to say the more diversity, the better. And the president and his administration are clearly coming down even harder on the side of we have to let these people in. I heard the president ridiculing those who would, you know, all of these governors have put up a fuss about, you know, we don't want these Syrians coming into our states. And he's ridiculing them and saying, you know, apparently these people are afraid of, you know, orphans and widows. They're afraid of three-year-olds and this type of thing. Like, anyone who would have any concern about this is just basically inventing a fictionalized threat.
Yeah, it's gone beyond civil conversation. It's like you said, if you don't agree with that idea of increasing immigration, you're a racist. But the reality is there are very real questions that need to be answered. Vetting is one of them. A lot of people talk, well, we'll vet these people who come through, make sure. Well, look at how our vetting has failed in Afghanistan and Iraq. Our soldiers are being killed by allies that we supposedly vetted. I mean, these are very, very real threats.
And well, you just had a former CIA director come out and say that we cannot vet them if they haven't done anything in their home country. There's nothing that's going to hit the radar screen. Basically, you know, you can't vet someone for something they haven't done yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And even people that have done things yet, these are people coming from some of the most corrupt countries in the world. You can get any identification you want in these countries. And I'm not talking about fake identification. I mean, if you want legitimate Syrian government-issued identification, that's available for a price. Anybody can get that. And those in the know that are doing the vetting realize that. And so these Republican governors, a lot of the Americans in general have very legitimate concerns over this. Do you want to be the person that has a refugee coming next to you that may or may not have been vetted? You know, I think that's a legitimate concern.
I'd like to just bring Anthony into the discussion. This is another article that we have in this week's Trumpet Weekly from Carolyn Glick. This is something that Stephen Fleury has been talking about on the Trumpet Daily program. You want to just tell us about this other article here?
Yes, as you mentioned, this is pretty much connected with what we see developing, where people are refusing to face the real problem that we have. The real problem is, first of all, identifying the enemy. And it seems like the United States, especially the leadership in the United States, they are refusing to identify the enemy. And the enemy is radical Islam. At a recent Democratic debate, none of the candidates wanted to identify that enemy. And Carolyn Glick, in an article, she talks about radical Islam as the invisible enemy, because no one wants to identify it. And yet it is the reason for the problems that we are seeing here. She goes on to explain in an article that radical Islam is an ideology that serves both as an organizing principle for civil societies and a military doctrine. So Islam, radical Islam, is tied to all these terrorist attacks that we're seeing. And as long as the leaders do not want to face that, or do not want to identify that threat, then they will not be able to solve the problems that we face.
Yeah, it seems like that kind of thinking is really what leads to very tone-deaf statements like those that the president has made that Stephen Fleury was highlighting on his program, where he's saying, you know, the world is getting less violent, and we have to keep in mind that these so many of these refugees are coming from, they're fleeing terrorism themselves. You know, we need to be more concerned about them than we are with our own safety. Those are not his words, but that's in effect what he's saying. And calling what happened in Paris a setback, you know, continuing to insist that we're actually gaining ground against ISIS. It's really a remarkable divide between those who are in Europe beginning to wake up and to realize something needs to change, and those who doesn't seem to matter what the evidence is. They just continue to insist on the same narrative that they've been pushing all along. Before we close this first segment, Rob, I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk about the overview of any other headlines from Anglo-America from this past week.
Sure, I have a couple of other things for you. First is that we should perhaps be prepared for the biggest El Nino ever, and possibly after that, a subsequently killer La Nina. Pacific Ocean water temperatures hit a record high during the week of November 9th. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said on Tuesday, and this makes El Nino the strongest in recorded history. The last record high, if you remember, was back in 1997. And analysts say if history repeats, which it tends to do with these El Nino events, it could lead to some very dramatic and rough weather in the U.S. Pacific Northwest and West Texas over the next several months. It could also mean drought in other places like Australia and the South Pacific. The other thing they say to watch is that the last time this happened, we had a super strong La Nina, which followed, which led to up to that point, which was the worst hurricane season on record. Hurricane Mitch, if you remember back to 1998. The other item I wanted to bring you was that China on Saturday welcomed backing from the IMF and from the IMF's panel of experts that the yuan should be included in its reserve currency special drawing rights. That's part of the global financial economic system that is run out of the IMF. And it looks like finally the yuan will be admitted to that basket of currencies. And as we mentioned before, this is just another step in China's plan to internationalize the yuan and make it a reserve currency and to challenge the dollar's role as the world's only reserve currency.
Well, these articles are in this week's Trumpet Weekly. This is our report that we produce each week, a very informative, very high quality report with the most significant stories from around the world. I'd encourage you to subscribe to this report. Just go online to thetrumpet.com to become a Trumpet Weekly subscriber, along with, 31,000 other people, something like that. Coming up, we're going to look at important news from the Middle East and Asia, and later on, our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world. We're going to transition now to the Middle East. And Anthony, let's start with an overview of the headlines from the region.
Well, this week, Israel said that 55 Iranians were killed in the Syrian war. This information was reported by an Israeli think tank that's close to Israel's spy services. Now, that's a lot of casualties, and the article says that the toll is undermining support among Iranians for Iran's actions in Syria. Hezbollah's death toll is between 1,000 and 2,000, and one source said that at the peak of the war, the Iranian force deployed in Syria was made up of about 1,800 personnel, and now that number has been reduced to about 1,300. Now, speaking of Syria, there's another article that says that the German army could join the United Nations Syria mission. Now, German ministers told Der Spiegel that they are not ruling out deployment of troops to Syria, provided that there is a United Nations resolution covering any military intervention. So Germany wants a presence there. And the article also goes on to say that Germany is increasing its presence in other areas like Afghanistan. And the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, has called for the current deployment to be halved. But he was coming up against a lot of opposition from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. So we see Iran suffering a lot of casualties in Syria. And that's going to affect what's going to happen in Syria. And at the same time, you see Germany getting a lot more interested in what's going on in that region.
Yeah, both of those stories... items that any longtime Trumpet reader would take a deep interest in. So your top story from this week.
Spiegel Online has an article about the Islamic State's new strategy, and that is taking terror abroad. It says, the attacks in Paris mark a shift in the Islamic State's strategy. For the first time, the Syrian jihadists have organized attacks abroad, making the terrorist organization look more like Al-Qaeda. So essentially, the Islamic State is the new Al-Qaeda. But before we continue, I think it's important just to mention something very important about the Islamic State. The Islamic State wants this kind of attention. They want to be known as a global threat and not just a regional threat. So they do want this kind of attention. In fact, I think it's kind of interesting just looking at Iran and the Islamic State, the way they use propaganda, the way they use the media. Iran wants to use the media to make themselves look less menacing than they actually are. And the Islamic State wants to use the media to make themselves look more menacing than they actually are, relatively speaking. Now, some people are aware of that Islamic State propaganda, but they then dismiss pretty much the global threat that the Islamic State actually has now. But this Paris attack proves that Iran is a threat just as much as the Islamic State is a threat. The Paris attack proved that the Islamic State can pose a global threat to the world. And that's essentially what this article is talking about. It talks about intelligence officials who have said that these attacks were orchestrated by high-level Islamic State operatives in Syria. It talks about the Charlie Hebdo attack early on in the year. That one wasn't necessarily coordinated by the Islamic State. However, it was inspired by the Islamic State. The terrorists involved in that attack drew inspiration from what the Islamic State is doing. So essentially, that's all the Islamic State has been able to do, just inspire lone wolf attacks. But for the first time with this Paris attack, the Islamic State actually coordinated attacks beyond the borders of Syria and specifically in Europe. So that's it. That is a really big development.
You know, it is interesting to watch this develop, and knowing that it is this radical group, Islamic State, that's at the center of all of this, everything that's happening here. Because when we look at things through the lens of biblical prophecy, we really do expect that it will be Iran at the center of this controversy, at the center that will be provoking a war with Europe. And in one sense, you look at what the Islamic State is doing, and it's easy to see how it's exactly the same kind of extremism, the same kind of Islamic terrorism that is provoking Europe right now. Europe is responding really robustly to what has happened, and we expect that to increase. But it's not going to be, as far as the way that it's established in biblical prophecy, it's not going to be some little group that's actually working in opposition to Iran or at odds with Iran. It's going to be Iran that's leading it. I think the contrast that you made between just the way that these two entities, Islamic State and Iran, are using the media and just trying to project their image really does show quite a contrast between the two. Not, I think the Islamic State, it's almost like they calculate their actions based on the shock value and based on trying to provoke a response. Iran has a much more canny, much more media savvy approach from the standpoint of like trying to project themselves as a legitimate power. And yet ultimately, we're expecting the provocation from Iran to be far greater than that from this terrorist group.
There was an article that I found. This was written by George Friedman of Stratfor. And he wrote this after the Charlie Hebdo attack early on this year. And he said that it is hard for anyone to distinguish which Muslims will kill and which Muslims will not. He was just reporting reality. And he said that the Muslim community might be able to make the distinction, but a 25-year-old European or American policeman cannot. So that's a problem that Europe is facing right now. And with the Paris attacks, they're waking up to reality. They now know that something has to be done. They now know that they need to identify the enemy. And if they do identify the enemy, if they do realize that we probably have something to do, we probably have to do something about what's happening with these radicals. Imagine what Iran would be thinking right now. They need to arm themselves. They feel like they probably have to have the bomb now, because Europe will not be able to distinguish which Muslim will kill, which Muslims will not kill, especially among those who are vocal about trying to destroy Europe.
Yeah, it's a very valid point. I think in one sense, it doesn't matter what the name of the organization that any given Muslim terrorist is a member of. As far as Europe is concerned, a Muslim terrorist is a Muslim terrorist. And whether it's coming from the Islamic State or whether they are a citizen of Iran and they're on orders from the IRCG, it doesn't matter. You have to take action against them. So the hardening of the position of the Europeans against this threat, ultimately, we could easily see that being directed against the state of Iran, even though at this point it's the Islamic State. A push is a push, and it seems like in general terms, I don't think any European would put too fine a point on, you know, this group versus that group. And so you can see how even these events are leading toward a fulfillment of the prophecies that we're expecting to in the time ahead. Well, thank you for that, Anthony. You're listening to our Week in Review program, and we're going to turn our attention now to Asia and to Jeremiah Jacques. Start with the overview of Asian headlines from this week.
Okay, well, first, we had a major update this week about the Russian plane that was downed over Egypt's Sinai Peninsula last month. Until this week, Russian authorities did not believe that that crash was connected with terrorists. They said it was just a tragic accident. But this week, President Vladimir Putin came out and said that crash was the result of a bomb planted by Islamic State terrorists. And Putin also offered a $50 million bounty to anyone who can find those responsible for blowing it up. And then China this week also pledged to bring to justice the Islamic State terrorists responsible for executing a Chinese national. That announcement came just after the Islamic State published the new edition of its online magazine. And in that magazine, it said that it had killed a Chinese national that it had been holding captive for quite a while. So China called the execution a savage act devoid of humanity. So the Islamic State is really just stirring up a lot of rage right now among some very powerful Asian nations.
Amazing. And your top story for the week?
Well, the big story is that America should fear China's Air Force. A new report published by the RAND Corporation says that today, the United States would need 15 times as many aircraft to defend Taiwan as it did back in 1996. That was just 20 years ago. But during those 20 years, China has rapidly advanced its air capability. So this RAND report used math-based air warfare models to analyze a very specific scenario, and that is how many air wings the United States would need to achieve 24/7 air dominance over Taiwan in the event of a Chinese invasion there. And so an air wing is a fleet of 72 aircraft. It's got an operation group, a support group, a logistics group, a medical group, and sometimes some others. And this report analyzed this scenario for the year 1996, and then it compared it also to 2017, just projecting ahead a little bit based on China's current rates of air advancement and production. And the results were really staggering. In 1996, China would have basically been a pushover. America would have needed just 2.1 air wings in order to maintain air dominance over Taiwan and to kind of reverse a Chinese invasion. So basically, without even breaking a sweat, with fewer than 150 aircraft, America could achieve that air superiority. So that was 1996. But now, to achieve the same thing, air dominance over Taiwan, the U.S. would need 29.9 air wings, which is about 2,000 aircraft. So in other words, that's far more aircraft than America could have even the faintest hope of realistically deploying against China to defend Taiwan. So that's 15 times more than America would need to defend its ally in just a period of 20 years. So this report is not based on a comprehensive air warfare analysis. It's only an approximation, but the picture that it paints is still really sobering. And this report also comes at a time of dramatic changes underway in the Taiwanese politics, which many analysts say really increase the likelihood of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. China has always viewed Taiwan as a part of China. Beijing kind of sees Taiwan as a rogue, breakaway state, and China has often vowed to use force to dominate Taiwan. But the current president of Taiwan, President Ma, he's been in power for 8 years now, and he's made all kinds of concessions to China, and China loves him for it. Under Ma, China hasn't really felt the need to officially invade and dominate Taiwan because Taiwan is just, it's just so submissive to China that China has felt that it already has kind of a de facto control over Taiwan. But President Ma is set to leave office on January 16th of next year. And the polling data indicates that his party, the KMT, will probably lose to Taiwan's Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP. And in previous years, when the DPP has been in power, it has taken a really cold stance toward China. It has aggressively pushed for a kind of a Taiwanese pro-independence agenda, not giving in to Beijing on much of anything at all. So if the DPP returns to power, it would probably work to reverse all of those moves toward China that Taiwan has made under President Ma. So then you have to ask, would Beijing tolerate a Taiwan that is less cooperative than it has been under President Ma? And I would say likely not. And then when you consider how weak the U.S. foreign policy is right now, it just greatly emboldens China, and it exponentially, I think, increases the likelihood that that China could attempt an invasion. So I think that 2016 really could be a time when China reacts and maybe tries to swallow up Taiwan.
You have an article about this China-Taiwan situation in the Trumpet edition that we've just sent off to the printer. We're sending that today. Two things that strike me about this. One are just, Rand can concoct these scenarios and look at the math and that type of thing, but the fundamental reality is that the United States is nowhere near committed enough to even defend Taiwan. You know, you can talk about 2.1 air wings or 29.9 air wings, but either of those would require a certain amount of will and would require a certain amount of determination to commit military resources to defend Taiwan against China militarily. And it seems like there's very little evidence that it has that will. One other thought I had was that you just wonder how much of this increase in Chinese air superiority has come as a result of spying on American technology and how much they're using America's technology against it. But the other thing is, it seems like this is the type of reality that has dictated the softer posture that Ma has had toward China. And you almost wonder if even if another party comes into power in Taiwan, if they wouldn't feel obligated to kind of carry in that same vein, simply because of the realities of a possible Chinese invasion, doing anything that they could to try to prevent that from ever happening.
That is a very likely scenario, I think. The DPP is responding to a Taiwanese backlash against Ma. A lot of people in Taiwan have protested how pro-China Ma has been. And so that's one of the main reasons why his party is projected to lose to the DPP, because they say, you know, Taiwan is not submissive to China. And a lot of Taiwanese really get behind that message. We are Taiwan. We are separate from China. But really, if you look at the facts on the ground, without a solid backing from America, they could pretend to really stand up to China all they wanted to. But I think that realistically, they know that America's will is broken. Its security assurances are not, you know, they're not really something they can count on. And so they may be elected on a platform of pro-independence, but once they come into power, I would be curious to see how strong they could be with that platform. I would imagine they would have to back down on that.
Yeah, pragmatism seems like it would dictate the need for at least a more conciliatory policy toward China. And it's just one more theater or one more area in China's neighborhood where you see these nations having to capitulate or having to at least acknowledge the reality of just how strong China is becoming. And I think Taiwan, just this little island nation right there in China's shadow, has got to be feeling the brunt of that pressure as much as anyone in the area. Well, fascinating story. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly, our weekly news report. The stories that we're talking about in the program today are in this week's edition. We're going to finish up with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we're going to start with Anthony.
Okay, last week on this program, we talked about the EU's decision to label Israeli products from Judea, Samaria, and the Golan Heights. We talked about how Hamas say that it's a step in the right direction. Hamas hopes that this could develop into totally boycotting all products from Israel. But now you have Israel planning to sue the EU for that decision to label products from Israeli settlements. Officials from the Israeli Justice Ministry and the Strategic Affairs Ministry have consulted a number of international law firms on how the nation could file a lawsuit against the EU. But then some officials from the Foreign Ministry and the Economy Ministry are a little bit concerned about that. They believe that suing the EU could actually do more harm than good. They say that Arab nations could unite against Israel and maybe push for total boycott of Israeli goods through the World Trade Organization. But that's not it. That's not even to mention how the EU itself will react if Israel files a lawsuit against it.
All right. Thank you, Anthony. We'll turn now to Richard.
The Paris attack is another force that could be pushing Europe to shrink down. So if for quite a long time on the Whip Trumpet and in the Plain Truth magazine before then, we've been saying that Europe would be a union of 10 nations or a group of 10 nations. Currently, the EU is 28 nations. It's much bigger. And it's unwieldy, it's slow, it takes them a long time to get anything done. After the Paris attack, the Dutch are saying that this common border area that they have within the EU is just too big. They're saying we can't have all these southern European countries that are being flooded with immigrants within our open border area. It's not working, it's not secure, we need to shrink down. And we have an article in the Trumpet Weekly called Considering a Northern Europe Alliance that talks about this. And this article is even already a bit out of date. When it was written, this was a little bit speculative. It wasn't entirely certain that the Dutch were pushing this. Now it's been confirmed. The Dutch government has indeed been in talks with Germany and about others about shrinking down this open border area. And this article notes, the map the Dutch government has in mind bears a remarkable resemblance to the Holy Roman Empire in the late 18th century. And they're exactly right. And then they talk about how this smaller group that's mainly in the West, they also talk about the Visegrad group, a group of four or five Eastern European nations that are talking about moving together. So this particular proposal may go nowhere. I think it may well be expanded to include France because that's the big sticking point with Germany. But it shows exactly where people in Europe are thinking now. They're thinking we need to shrink down. We need to get to a group that is manageable. And then we can draw closer, have that cooperation that we need to secure our borders. Then we can become more powerful and we can confront these crises. So we can see a very strong indication there of another major event that's going to emerge out of all of these crises.
Great stuff, Richard. Let's turn now to Jeremiah.
Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin has been transformed from an outcast to a problem solver in the eyes of the world's most powerful nations. These nations, called the G20 or the Group of 20, they meet every year to discuss policy issues pertaining to just the promotion of international financial stability and other international issues. And listeners may remember that last year when the G20 met in Australia, Putin ended up leaving early, kind of in a huff. He was tired of being scolded by all the world leaders for Russia's actions there in Ukraine. But now, here we are 12 months on, and the situation is entirely reversed. The Financial Times said, an audience with the Russian president was one of the hottest tickets in town at the G20, because Western leaders were forced to recognize that the road to peace in Syria inevitably runs through Moscow. So Putin is suddenly an international problem solver that the West can't ignore, whether the topic is shifting airstrikes in Syria to the Islamic State rather than bombing other Syrian rebels, or backing a political settlement in Ukraine. Mr. Putin holds the cards, and so the West is coming to him for all of those answers. So this is just another proof of America's retreat on the global stage. Putin is filling the void quickly, and it's also a proof of how much more dangerous the world is becoming as a result of that U.S. retreat.
That's phenomenal development. And it was about right about the time that he left the G20 a year ago, where people were writing his epitaph and saying that he was going to have to kind of slink off into the sunset. So much for that idea. Next, on to Robert.
Well, can anything stop companies from loading up on debt? That was a question that investment bank UBS asked this week. Companies have been taking advantage of record low interest rates to load up on debt, lock in those interest rates, and go on a spree of share buybacks, mergers, acquisitions. But now the Federal Reserve is telegraphing that we are getting to the point where it will begin raising interest rates. That'll be the first time interest rates have risen in almost a decade. And investors are starting to wonder what is going to happen to this debt binge. And this is what UBS was trying to answer this week. And in a note that it published, it went through and it looked at various factors that it said could potentially derail the debt train that U.S. companies have been on. And their answer, pretty much nothing. And to me, it was just startling, the complacency that's out there. This is reminding, reminiscent a lot of the conditions back in 2006, 2007, before the last economic crash. Remember, companies today have 50% more debt than they had just 8 years ago. So they've been on an epic debt binge. And UBS says they don't see anything that could derail it, even rising interest rates. They say companies need this debt. But the one thing that they brought out that I found most interesting was this. They took a look at the debt rating agencies and they said, well, what would happen if the debt rating agencies began to downgrade corporate debt in America? These companies have so much more debt. Surely they're more of a credit risk today. And they said, you know what? I don't think we have to worry about that because these credit rating agencies get paid by the companies to rate them. So there's a built-in incentive for the credit rating agencies not to downgrade any of these companies because they'll just go shopping elsewhere to another debt rating agency. And this is the exact thing, same thing that was happening back in 2006, 2007 with subprime debt. Everybody knew the subprime debt was junk debt. It was garbage debt. But the rating agencies were telling investors around the world, this is AAA gold. Go ahead and keep binging. We know what happened next.
Unbelievable. Well, in light of recent high-profile cases of university student sensitivities, comes a Daily Caller article, Columbia student claims to be traumatized by reading about white people. The article says a student at Columbia University is urging the school to inject more diversity into its required courses, claiming she suffered severe emotional trauma from reading too many books by and about white people. This past Wednesday night, they had a panel discussion called Race, Ethnicity, and University Life. One of the panelists was a student named Nisi Aya, and she was supposed to graduate in 2014, but it's taken her longer than expected. Why is that? She says that part of it is because of the core classes that she has to take on the culture and history of Western European civilization. She says it's traumatizing to sit in core classes. We're looking at history through the lens of these powerful white men. I have no power or agency as a black woman. So where do I fit in? As an example, she talked about her art class. She said that the Congolese artwork was repeatedly characterized as primitive. She wanted to object to that characterization, but in the Spectator's words, she was tired of already having worked that day to address so many other instances of racism and discrimination. And, of course, the associate dean for the core curriculum said that her views were perfectly legitimate. This article quotes him as saying how she was helping everyone at the discussion to understand, quote, the way that racism shapes how we see the world and our institutions. Thomas Sowell wrote a column this week where he said, racism is not dead, but it is on life support, kept alive mainly by the people who use it for an excuse or to keep minority communities fearful or resentful enough to turn out as a voting bloc on election day.
You know what, Mr. Hilliker? I have a solution for this lady. She can go to Africa. That's where I'm from. I'm from Zimbabwe. They don't talk too much about Western civilization. So she can go to Africa. Then she won't have that kind of trauma that she's talking about.
Thank you, Anthony. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. That has all the stories that we've talked about in the program this week. We'd love to hear from you if you email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Richard Palmer, Anthony Chabatterway, Jeremiah Jacques, and Robert Morley.
Great to be here.
Good to be here.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of John F. Kennedy. Do not pray for easy lives. Pray to be stronger men. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.